This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, 64-year-old Palestinian prisoner and cancer patient Maysara Abu Hamdia dies in a hospital bed. We'll speak with our contributor Lina Al-Safin about his imprisonment, neglect, and death, the waves of protests afterwards, and brutality by Israeli forces who shot and killed two teenagers during protests on Wednesday.
17-year-old Ahmed Nassar was shot in the chest and was killed. The Israeli army, they prevented medical staff or the ambulance from reaching him for 30 minutes.
Also, Israel's siege tips Gaza's waste management to a crisis point. Rami Al-Megadi reports from the Gaza Strip as people protest recent cutbacks in aid from the United Nations, and news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, including a huge announcement from the Teachers Union of Ireland, which just called for an academic boycott of Israel in a unanimous vote, becoming the first European academic union to do so, while the Student Senate at UC Riverside in Southern California votes to overturn a recent divestment resolution after Zionist pressure. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, Associate Editor for the Electronic Intifada in Berkeley. We begin in the West Bank. The Electronic Intifada's contributor Lina Al-Safin reported that 64-year-old Maysara Abu Hamdia, a Palestinian prisoner who was suffering from throat and spinal cancer, passed away on Tuesday. He died in Saroka Hospital. This marks the second time in less than 2 months that a Palestinian prisoner has died in custody, noted Al-Safin. Arafat Jaradat was tortured to death in Megiddo prison on February 23rd. Al-Safin added that Maysara Abu Hamdia was arrested during the Second Intifada in May of 2002, with, quote, a long list of charges issued against him, mostly stemming from political party affiliations. Abu Hamdia's son Tariq told the Electronic Intifada that, quote, my father spent 105 days at the Muscovia Detention Center under interrogation, referring to the notorious Jerusalem interrogation facility known in English as the Russian Compound. Quote, he never gave the interrogator any information. Israel found great difficulty in determining which faction he belonged to. In the 70s, they thought he was working with the PFLP, the leftist Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Now they are accusing him of being affiliated with Hamas, while at the same time cooperating with Fatah. Al-Safin reports that in June 2005, Abu Hamdia was sentenced to prison for 25 years. 2 years later, in April 2007, the Israeli military prosecutors appealed his sentencing and his sentence was extended to 99 years in prison. Abu Hamdia was regarded as a leader by the other prisoners due to his older age and sentence, and spent the years in Eshel prison in the Negev or Nakab desert. Since 1967, 51 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails have died from medical negligence. There are currently 700 prisoners in need of medical attention and 18 alone in the Ramleh prison hospital, according to the Palestine News Network. 21 prisoners began a hunger strike on March 31st in Eshel prison in support of Maysara Abu Hamdia, according to news reports. They were attacked with batons and tear gas and dragged off to solitary confinement by the prison authorities as a means of pressuring them to quit. Following Maysara Abu Hamdia's death on April 2nd, protests erupted in the West Bank, while thousands of mourners attended Abu Hamdia's funeral in Hebron. Israeli occupation forces opened fire on protesters in the city of Tulkarem, killing two teenage boys in separate incidents on Wednesday. Amr Nassar, 17 years old, was shot and killed near a checkpoint, and then just hours later, Israeli soldiers also shot 18-year-old Naji al-Balbisi, according to Man News Agency. Other injuries were reported during protests in Bethlehem, Jerusalem, and dozens of Palestinians were wounded in Hebron. Joining us to talk about the current situation on the ground in the occupied West Bank is our contributor, Lina Al-Safin. She joins us from Ramallah. Lina, thank you so much for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So if you could talk about Maysara Abu Hamdia's death in the context of the level of medical neglect in Israeli prisons right now.
Well, Maisel Abahamdi began complaining of a sickness in August 2012. He had trouble breathing. He was coughing up blood. As his lawyer, Rani Al-Alami, told me, Maisel was only transferred to the hospital from August 2012 until December 2012, a maximum of 2 to 3 times only. And then in January, Maisel lost his voice in addition to a lot of the weight. And of course, during this entire time, the hospital staff, they were running tests on him. So they obviously knew that he was afflicted with cancer, but they didn't tell him that. And then in March was when they began giving him chemotherapy sessions or chemotherapy treatments. But again, he wasn't full-time in the hospital. He was being transferred from the prison to the hospital. And it wasn't until 3 days before his death where he fell unconscious and lost, he couldn't feel his body in the prison. It wasn't until then that they transferred him to the hospital where he was shackled to a hospital bed and three guards were keeping watch over him 24/7. And then, of course, after the 3 days, Maisel died. And this follows a long pattern of medical negligence. I mean, since 1967, 52 prisoners have died because of that. And recently we have Ashraf Abu Dreya, who died from Hebron. And last year, Zuhair Lubada from Nablus, he was released from prison and straight to the Nablus National Hospital. He didn't even go home, and he was in a coma, and then a week later he was dead. So this again follows the policy of Israeli prison authorities.
Lina, you reported also that that Maisara's son, Tarek, delivered a message of his own to the Palestinian Authority. What role does the PA play in this kind of situation, especially in terms of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli detention?
It plays a role of coordination or collaboration. The Minister of Prisons Affairs, Issa Karaka, said that he blamed the Israeli authorities because they informed the Ministry of Prisoner Affairs that of Maisel's condition, and it was too late to do anything then. But they were in contact, the PA and the Israeli authorities. And according to the Palestinian Authority, they said that the Israeli authorities were working hard to either secure the release of Maisel so he can die among his family, but they promised to give him the required treatment. And of course, I think that's just absurd. Why place your trust in your occupier? You know, the Ministry of Prisoners says they shouldn't even, its role is very symbolic. I mean, it doesn't really do anything other than issue condemnations and that sort of stuff, and maybe weekly rallies. But achieving objective goals, that's unfortunately non-existent.
Lina, talk about some of the protests that have happened across the West Bank after the death of Maisara Abu Hamdia, and also the brutality that Israeli forces have meted out against protesters. On Wednesday, Israeli forces killed two teenagers in separate incidents in Tulkarem. Talk about what's happened since his death.
Well, the majority of the protests have taken place in Maisel Abahamdi's hometown of Hebron. The protests have continued for 3 days, and of course the protests are met with the usual repressive force by the Israeli occupation army, with rubber bullets and tear gas canisters, and in some cases even live ammunition. There are reports of cases of dozens of injuries, but none were serious. And then on Wednesday night in Tulkarem, a protest broke out, and 17-year-old Ahmed Nassar was shot in the chest and was killed. The Israeli army, they prevented medical staff or the ambulance from reaching him for 30 minutes and actually shot at a group of young men who tried to reach him. Ahmed's cousin, Naji Balbisi, was found later that morning at around 5 a.m. He was shot in the head, I think with a rubber bullet. But he managed to run away, and I think he collapsed and succumbed to his wounds. And he was reported missing for those hours that nobody knew where he was until he was found at 5 a.m. But obviously, on Thursday, that's when the funerals of the two teenagers from Tulkarem took place, in addition to Maisra Hamdiya's funeral in Hebron. But, I mean, for all the talk about, you know, the West Bank breaking out into large-scale protests, unfortunately, to be to be brutally honest, that didn't happen. I mean, in Hebron, of course, the protests, they did happen, but in other parts of the West Bank, that was mostly non-existent, especially in Ramallah, which didn't even observe a general strike, unlike the cities of Nablus, Hebron, and even East Jerusalem.
Well, finally, Lina, can you give us an update on the current Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jail who are on hunger strike and, you know, their ongoing situation and how this fits into the context of what's happening all across Palestine right now?
Instead of people talking about a third intifada, and I believe that we are still years away from that, I think they should start instead focusing on the intifada that is happening in the prison, inside the Israeli prisons currently. We had all prisoners, approximately 4,600 prisoners, hunger strike or refuse food the following morning after Mesut Hamdi's death was announced. And we also had the protests there inside prisons, which, of course, were met by brutal force from the Israeli prison authorities who threw tear gas canisters at the prisoners and beat them up. And I think it was around 84 prisoners, as a punishment for their protests, were transferred to different prisons. And then, of course, the longest hunger strike, the Samir Issawi. Unfortunately, the solidarity has been very weak, even in local media, even with local activists. There's absolutely nothing done to highlight his very dangerous situation. Even though his lawyer kept saying that at any moment now, Sam is expected to die because his heart rate is very weak. There is on some level there is this. The reaction, the angry reaction that we cannot let a third prisoner die, especially after Arafat Jaradat, who was tortured to death on February 23rd. But at the same time, people have lost hope in the Palestinian Authority, the so-called leadership. And one interesting thing that I forgot to mention, but I would like to highlight, is that during Mesut Abu-Hamdiya's funeral, he was, of course, carried by the PA security forces. Mesut Abu-Hamdiya used to be a general in the PA, preventative security forces, so they would offer him that kind of tribute, I would say. But again, the funeral procession proceeded in a very Western fashion, according to his son, Tariq, who denounced the playing of music, the bagpipes and the drums during the funeral, and said that this is actually a disgrace to my father's memory. This is the PA that's done nothing to help my father, and now they're giving him a proper burial. It just speaks of hypocrisy. And I think that also explains the reason why there's a lack of protests, because the Palestinian Authority, they're actually smarter than we give them credit for, and they've completely interspersed the protests with security forces, either those in uniforms or those within plain clothes.
All right, well, we're going to keep watching the situation very carefully. And as always, Lina El-Safan, thank you so much for the good information and for all your contributions to the Electronic Intifada. For much more on this story and to read more of Lina's reports, visit electronicintifada.net. Lina, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Reporting from Gaza, Eva Bartlett wrote this week that Gaza's waste management is at a crisis point due to Israel's ongoing siege, which bans entry of construction materials. The most critical issues include overflowing landfills, non-functioning collection vehicles, waste site toxins leaking into the groundwater, and no means of hazardous waste disposal, Bartlett reports. Abdelrahim Abulkumboz, the director of health and environment at the municipality of Gaza, told Bartlett that the municipality has 75 collection vehicles, quote, over half of which are completely unusable. The rest have been in use for more than 15 years and are in need of repair. Because of the Israeli import bans, we can't get the parts we need for maintenance. We get some of them through the tunnels from Egypt, which is expensive and not guaranteed, unquote. The most urgent issue, he says, is the overflowing landfills. Expansion of Gaza's landfills has thus far been impossible due to the lack of construction materials and the routine Israeli army attacks in border regions where the three main dumps are located. Bartlett adds that, quote, a February 2011 World Bank report had noted even back then that the Gaza Strip's three main landfills are reaching their maximum capacity. The report further noted that the landfill situation, quote, has been further aggravated by the Israeli military actions, which resulted in substantial amounts of demolition debris of damaged buildings, some of which is contaminated with hazardous substances. Other hazardous substances in Gaza's waste sites include asbestos used on many roofs in Gaza and found amidst bombing debris, chemicals and toxins from Israeli bombs, and hazardous healthcare waste from hospitals, including infectious or pathogenic waste, blood and body fluids, and radioactive or chemical waste, according to a September 2009 United Nations Environmental Programme report. During the winter 2008 to 2009 Israeli attacks on Gaza, quote, incinerators did not function due to electricity shortages. All landfills thus indiscriminately received hazardous materials such as healthcare waste, the United Nations report notes. Add to that more than 35,000 cattle, sheep, and goats, and more than 1 million birds and poultry killed in the attacks, which Gaza's landfills did not have the means to dispose of hygienically. These were excerpts of a longer report by Eva Bartlett. For much more on this story, visit electronicintifada.net. UNRWA, the United Nations Agency for Palestine Refugees, decided on Thursday to temporarily close food distribution centers in the Gaza Strip after crowds of angry protesters stormed UNRWA's headquarters in Gaza City in protest of recent cutbacks in aid as Israel's years-long siege on Gaza continues. The Electronic Intifada's Rami Al-Megari has more from Gaza.
Director of UNRWA operations in Gaza, Robert Turner, says the large-scale food distribution program for more than 800,000 refugees in Gaza will continue unchanged, but the closure of centers was necessary for the safety of UNRWA's staff in the territory. In a statement, the operation director respected the people's right to demonstrate, but described storming the UNRWA headquarters as being unacceptable and disturbing. In the Gaza Strip, committees for Palestinian refugees have called recently for demonstrating against UNRWA's decision to cut off regular financial aid to thousands of impoverished households in Gaza. But the UN contends that the cutoff was essential for budget shortfalls and that instead the UNRWA has expanded a job creation program to mitigate the effects of the reduction of cash distribution to the poorest refugee families. Over the past 2 years, demonstrations against the UNRWA have intensified, mainly in regards to service reduction or in protest against UNRWA's decision to fire a union leader. Tensions are growing amidst frequent financial budget deficits of UNRWA, which provides health, educational, social, food and sanitation services for Palestinian refugees for more than six decades now. Rami Al-Mighari, Electronic Intifada, Gaza.
This is Asa Winstanley in London, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. You're listening to our weekly podcast featuring news, views and analysis on Palestine and the issues affecting Palestinian human rights. Visit us on the web at electronicintifada.net or on Twitter at Intifada.
And now we go to news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. Asa Winstanley reported on Thursday that at its annual conference, an Irish lecturers' union voted for a comprehensive academic boycott of Israel, described by activists as the first such move of its kind in Europe. In a unanimous vote, the Teachers' Union of Ireland called on members to, quote, cease all cultural and academic collaboration with Israel, including the exchange of scientists, students, and academic personalities, as well as all cooperation in research programs. The motion also called for the Irish Congress of Trade Unions to step up its campaign for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against the apartheid state of Israel. David Landy, sociology lecturer at Trinity College in Dublin, welcomed the motion in an Ireland-Palestine Solidarity Campaign press release, explaining, quote, undoubtedly apologists for Israeli apartheid will complain that such motions stifle academic freedom, but this is nonsense. The Palestinian call for an academic boycott of Israel is an institutional boycott, not a boycott of individuals. The vote comes at a time when anti-BDS, pro-Israel lobbying groups are still reeling from a major setback in their campaign against academic boycotts of Israel. Only last week, a landmark ruling in a British tribunal comprehensively dismissed a Zionist legal attack on the University and College Union for merely discussing boycotts of Israel. In other news, in the U.S., the Student Senate at the University of California at Riverside voted on Wednesday night to rescind a divestment resolution passed last month, following intimidation and scare tactics employed by Israel advocates and on-campus Zionist groups against student senators. Members of such groups spoke at the meeting in repeated attempts to discredit the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, as well as the divestment resolution itself. The original resolution, which was passed on March 6th, has now been deleted from the Associated Student Government's records at UC Riverside, as it was rescinded. The students who supported the divestment resolution will informally address the Senate next week. They say they will continue addressing their concerns regardless of the divestment resolution process, which would have to begin from scratch once again. On Wednesday morning, before the vote to rescind the divestment resolution was cast, both Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu and rock legend Roger Waters of Pink Floyd sent letters of support to the UC Riverside Student Senate, urging the senators not to back down on the vote. Roger Waters was recently interviewed on the Electronic Intifada. That interview made world headlines and was quoted in Rolling Stone, Spin, The Daily Mail, and other major publications. Desmond Tutu said in part, quote, "I urge you to stand firm for equality and human rights, as well as against racism, Islamophobia, and anti-Semitism, and not to backtrack on your courageous vote. Just as we defeated apartheid in South Africa, so can we defeat Israel's brand of apartheid and help Palestinians and Israelis alike secure a future of peace and equality." For more on this story and other current news from the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, and to read more about the national and international student solidarity movements for Palestinian rights, check out our activism and BDS blog on electronicintifada.net. And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, pointed opinion and analysis, and action alerts by our team of correspondents and bloggers, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. This week, be sure to check out our newest features and op-eds, such as BBC defends false claims linking Rachel Corrie to killings of Israeli soldiers, Sightseeing Under Siege, a tourist map for Gaza, The Month in Pictures, a curated collection of photographs in and around Palestine during the last month, new music from Palestinian hip-hop legends Dam as they kick off a U.S. tour, his lies about brutal so-called Arab attack in France exposed, Israeli director Yariv Horowitz concocts new ones, and much more. At electronicintifada.net, you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and a special thanks to Flashpoints and KPFA in Berkeley. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.